Right, so it's a great pleasure for me to be here. Thanks for having me at the last minute. Michael and I are very good friends, and occasionally we do these kinds of things. In fact, I was in City Church Cambridge for many years, which is the New Frontiers Church in Cambridge. And when I moved to Oxford, before I came, Michael pulled me aside, and Michael goes to a different church, and he said, you know, our church has a really good, very, very good wine club. And so I changed churches, unfortunately. So it gives you a feeling of how spiritual we are. So what I want to tell you about today is something about science, which I love. And I'm going to begin by doing something I think we should do more in church. Just talk about the science, because I think science is something really beautiful. But then I'll look at, does science answer everything there is about life? As one or two of my colleagues in Oxford have been suggesting recently quite publicly. Or are there other ways of thinking that are maybe equally valid, or maybe even more valid for the important questions of life? So I'm going to talk about the limits of science, then I'll look at whether that way of thinking can help us reason towards God. And this is just, of course, we all know that our relationship with God is a very wide and broad thing, and this is just one way, hopefully, of looking at it. And hopefully you'll find it at the early somewhat amusing. So what kind of work do? I'm a theoretical physicist. I'm interested in theories of complex systems. In the last few years, I've been mainly looking at biology. So one of the things I'm interested in is, you know, we share 15% of our genes with E. coli, 25% with yeast, 70% with frogs, which is not quite enough to kiss a frog and make him a prince, but it's getting close, and 98% with chimpanzees. And I actually grew up in Gabon in Central Africa, where my parents worked as missionaries. And this is a picture of myself and a chimpanzee, our pet. And just to be absolutely clear, if you haven't picked that up yet, this is the chimpanzee, and that's me, okay? My mother said, although we look different, our behavior was remarkably similar. So I've been interested in these kinds of questions. And one of the other things I'm interested in is how things make themselves. So here's a little video I want to show you of a bacterium. This is from a Japanese group. It's an animation of a bacterium. A little motor inside a bacterium that spins a little tail with which it swims. And this little motor is incredibly small, and it spins at 100,000 RPM. Okay. And amazingly, this motor can stop in a quarter of a turn. One of my colleagues, Richard Berry, sticks the little bacteria down onto a slide and measures the torque of the machine. You can actually do that. And so it's a really amazing piece of machinery. But as you're looking at this little animation, what you may also see is things moving around and slotting together. Those are proteins, little molecules that stick together into certain three-dimensional shapes. It's making a little motor. And if you think about it, if I were to bring you this motor, a big size of it here, you'd assume that it was made in a factory or made by some kind of complicated robot. But these things make themselves. Okay, these things float around and they stick together. We'd say it's amazing. Right? I think it's really, really something extraordinary. And the first time I saw this movie, I thought, wait, how does that work? In fact, you may not realize this, but you have 10 times as many bacteria in your body as you have cells in your body. Okay. Before you all run off to the hospital, it's normal because bacteria are much smaller than your cells. They live in your gut, and they help digest things. In fact, you'd be quite ill if they weren't there. So you are, in fact, part bacteria. And as I speak, during my talk, your bacteria in your body are going to be doing this process many, many times over. It's just something to mull over. So I was interested in this, and I've been working on this problem. It's a bit complicated because there's so many things floating around. So I've actually worked on something more simple more recently, which are viruses. You all probably know what viruses are. They're little shells, okay? And about half the viruses have this circular shape, or the spherical shape, and all they are is a little shell with DNA inside that gets into your cells, makes copies of itself, that hijacks your cells, makes copies of itself until the cell blows up, and then it makes more copies of itself, and this is why you might feel ill. And what's amazing is that they have these little shapes, like this one, it's made of 12 pentagons, or this one is made of 12 pentagons and 20 hexagons. In fact, if you look at old footballs, you'll see they're stitched exactly the same way. So nature got there a long time before we did. And what I do in my lab, I'm a theorist, so I'll take something like this and I'll figure out, well, how do these things make themselves? And in fact, you can take these little viruses, take the DNA out, so all you have is little balls, okay? Put the little balls in a test tube. So let's say each of these is made of 12 pentagons. So if I put 100 of them in a little test tube, I have 1,200 pentagons floating around. And the amazing thing is that if I can change the concentration of the something like the salt, and it'll all fall apart. and they'll float around in separate units. And if I change it back, they'll pop right back into individual spheres. So that's really cool. I think that's cool. And I started learning about this a few years ago, and I thought, wow, how does that work? That is really cool. It's a little bit, I think, here's just an example from my lab. If you're interested in this, here's a bunch of computer viruses. Okay, they're not bad ones, but good ones. So we made a little model of these things. We put them in the computer. We let them move around randomly. And if you design them right, they spontaneously form these little spheres. So we've understood something about how viruses make themselves, which is pretty cool. And I'm trying to understand the mathematics of that. What's the mathematical principles that nature uses to make things make themselves? And I think that's cool. You think it's cool? Yeah? A few people are going, oh. In fact, I think it's a little bit like taking Lego blocks. Okay, this is what happens in nature. This is how you're making Lego blocks. Shaking them in a bag, and out comes a fully formed train. Okay? That's essentially what happens all the time in your body. And I think it's absolutely extraordinary. So I think science is really fun. In fact, I pinch myself that I get paid money. Okay, in fact, it's, for a lot of you, it's your tax money that paid you. Thank you very much. I get paid money to think about these things, okay, all the time. And that's amazing. One of the great things about being a scientist is you get actually paid to think about what you think is interesting. And that's cool. Okay? I hope you, those of you that are paying, worrying about your taxes, I hope you realize that there may be some applications to this. Right? We could make toys. We could also make nanomedicine. Some of my colleagues are using these things to make really cleverly targeted drugs that could target just a cancer cell, for example. And you can see that if we could understand how this works, the applications are amazing. But I just do it because I love it. I think it's the coolest thing ever. Now, science is fun. Being a scientist is also very fun. There's various stereotypes about scientists, which may or may not be true. Sometimes they're helpful. So I fly a lot for my work. I travel around the world. And sometimes I'm a bit tired, and you sit in a plane, and the person next to you wants to chat to you and talk to you. And usually they ask you what you do, and I say, I'm a theoretical physicist. That usually kills the conversation. If it doesn't, I say, they keep going, I say, I like equations. What's your favorite equation? And that's the end. So, when I was a student, my friends and I used to have this up on our wall. I finally figured out why we haven't had girlfriends. But anyway, it'd be true. I have since solved that problem, I should say. I'm now married, so... And before I forget, down here in the corner is a number you can text your questions to. So if you have any questions, that I'll treat as many as I can in the question and answer session. I'll be around a little bit afterwards as well for a few minutes if you have anything that you want to answer. So that's cool. So the question for tonight is not, can I teach you science? The question for tonight is not this. Will we one day understand how the flagellum assembles or even how it evolves? I think, yes, I think one day we will understand it. I hope. And I think it glorifies God to understand the thing. It says in the Bible that it's the glory of God to conceal things. It's the glory of kings to seek them out. But will we one day, as we understand more and more, as we understand maybe the flagellum, as we understand more and more, will we one day understand everything? Will that crowd God out? Will science one day explain everything that there is? And let's see. So that's the question I'm going to look at today. So I'll do, if I have time, four topics. Does science have limits? I'll look a little bit, give a scientific method. I'll introduce something called tapestry arguments. And don't worry, I know that whenever I give these kind of talks, for some of you, for whom science is a bit more like torture than anything else, you feel like you want to turn off your brains. But I think I've done this many times for general audiences, and I've been amazed at people with no scientific background, how much of the fundamental things that I'm saying they can pick up. So just hold on. Come with me for the ride, and hopefully by the end you'll be, I don't know if a little bit wiser, at least hopefully you'll have found something in it that you find interesting or amusing at the very least. So I'll talk about scientific method, I'll talk about questions that science and no advanced science could ever answer, and then I'll look at whether some of these ways of thinking can help us understand reasons for God. So does science have limits? Here's one of my colleagues, Peter Atkins, very famous chemist, and he, the quote here, I'll only read this a little bit. There is no reason to expect that science cannot deal with any aspect of existence. In fact, he says, I long for immortality, but I know that my only hope of achieving it is through science and medicine, not through sentiment and its subsets, art and theology. And what Atkins is saying here is science is going to eventually give us all the answers, And my, in fact, my wife was working in South Africa for the last 10 days or so. She just flew in this morning. And so we were chatting this morning before I headed off here. And she had one of those experiences where she spent a long time talking to a very bright person on the plane who basically said to her, look, I'm trying to find the meaning of life. I'm trying to find where what it's all about. And it must be science. And he was reading all the science because he had been convinced by people like Atkins and Dawkins and others that somehow science was going to lead him to the deep truth, the real truth of what it's all about. So this is what he was going. And I think that's wrong. And I'll show you, first of all, I'll show you an atheist who agrees with you that's wrong. So here's Sir Peter Medawar, one of the great Nobel Prize, one of the great Nobel Prize winners in Oxford, a medical scientist who wrote that there is indeed a limit upon science is made very likely by the existence of questions that science cannot answer, and that no conceivable advance of science would empower it to answer. These are the questions that children ask, the ultimate questions of Karl Popper. For those of you who don't know, Karl Popper is a famous philosopher. Okay? I have in mind this question is, how did everything begin? What are we all here for? And what is the point of living? So here, Medawar, a materialist, not a Christian in any sense of the imagination, is saying, actually, science can't answer these big questions, these really important questions. In fact, he says, science is a great and glorious enterprise, the most successful, I argue, that human beings have ever engaged in. To reproach it for its inability to answer all the questions we should like to put to it is no more sensible than to reproach a railway locomotive for not flying, or in general not performing any operation for which it was not designed. Which is a fancy way of saying, just because science can't answer every question doesn't mean there's something wrong with it. And in fact, what he's really saying, and I'll elaborate on that a little bit more, is that the power from science comes precisely from the limits that it sets itself. And that's why it's such a powerful and amazing thing, and a fun thing. So here we see two Oxford atheists disagreeing, and what they're really disagreeing about is not necessarily just what is science. Disagreeing on a question that's important for all of us, which is how do I obtain reliable knowledge about the world? How do I know that something is true? How do I know something is false? How do I know something is reliable or unreliable? That's a really, really important question. All of us in our day-to-day life struggle. We're always dealing with that. How do we know that something is true? Where do we base our lives on? Why do we believe that something is the right thing to do and not the wrong thing to do? How do we know these things are true? How do we know they're reliable? They're really, really important questions. And that's what these guys, in this case, arguing through the lens of science, but they're asking these really big questions. And so every single one of you in this room is, in fact, a little philosopher or a little theologian, because you're all making these kinds of assessments all the time about what's important and what's not. You can't say, well, I don't care about it, therefore I'm not. It's not the way it works. Either you do make, you always make decisions based on something, and that something may be something well thought out, or it may be what you happen to feel or think or what you saw on TV or what you think is cool or uncool. But at the end of the day, what you all need to do is think about how do you know something is true? How do you know something is false? How do you know something is reliable? How is it unreliable? That's a really, really important question. So we're going to look at this a little bit from the lens of science. So what is science? Okay, what's the scientific method? So here I have a slide on the scientific method. So traditionally, you're taught in school, you observe phenomena, you formulate a hypothesis, you test a hypothesis, you modify it, and eventually you establish a theory. The actual method, okay, is a little bit more like this. You make up a theory based on what the funding agency manager wants to be true. You design minimum experiments that will suggest the theory is true. You modify the theory to fit the data, publish a theory, rename a hypothesis, and then you defend despite all evidence to the contrary. Okay. Somewhere in between those two extremes is the way science really works. In fact, one of the things people often think is that science is about, you know, something you sit down, now you can have some science, and then you finish. It doesn't actually work that way. Scientists, many of us, our lives are a bit like people that do art or music. Sometimes, you know, inspiration hits, and I'll work sometimes, you know, day and night, and sometimes I can sit at my desk and nothing will come of it, and I just have to leave and go do something else, because science is a very interactive, very much an imaginative kind of subject. So between those are two different ways of looking at science. I actually want to introduce a third metaphor from one of my professors when I studied in the U.S. called David Merman that I find really, really helpful. And it's kind of interesting that I'm bringing this up because this is a metaphor by that he did as a response to what are called the science wars, the different big fights in the 1990s and early 2000s between sociologists of science who were based, many of them, here in Sussex. So it's called the Sussex School. So this is an anti-Sussex argument in many ways. And what he said, he pointed out, he said, actually, when we do science, it's not just simply linearly, I do something and then something else and something else. We do lots of different experiments. And we compare those experiments with each other. And eventually, we build up a picture about how something works. So let's say we build up a picture of quantum mechanics, which is the theory that physicists use for explaining really small things. And there's different experiments that we do, different mathematical theories that we do. And eventually, we weave them together into a tapestry. And he said, eventually you weave a tapestry together where these arguments cohere, and they have to make sense with each other, and eventually you can make something which is really, really strong. So today we understand that quantum mechanics can explain things like chemistry, explains many things about the material world. That's been many years of many threads being put together to something very, very strong. There are other scientific arguments, like questions about climate change, which are much more complicated. They're, perhaps the tapestry is a bit more fragile, and occasionally things will break. And one of the big questions for us today is, how is that tapestry strong or not? And it has real consequences. But fundamentally, science doesn't stand or fall by one single argument. It's many different things that are woven together. So that's just a way of thinking about what science is. That's how we do science. Does that make sense? Yes, that's a tapestry. Okay, so I think science is like making tapestries. And in fact, it's interesting that science itself is based on a whole series of assumptions that lie outside of science. So you can't build that tapestry without those assumptions. So what are those assumptions? So one of them is uniformity. Okay, that's a fancy word for, if I do an experiment in Oxford, and I do the same experiment in Cambridge under the same conditions, if the person in Cambridge is smart at least, they should get the same result. Okay. Now you and I think that's obvious, but for most people in history that's not obvious at all, because nature would not be regular, nature would be capricious, nature would do something here today and something else tomorrow. Okay. There's the same principle of rationality, the idea that you can actually understand nature, that it's intelligible. And historians of science, and I've named a few here, including my colleague, Oxford Peter Harrison, have shown that theological reflections on the fact that there's a God is a God of order, and that therefore we expect there to be uniformity, the same things here as in Cambridge, as in Oxford, that God is a God of logic, there's a logos behind the world, so we expect the world to be logical, to be intelligible. That those concepts had a really deep impact on the birth of modern science. Okay? That deep theological, and so science has very deeply Christian roots. That's why the founders of the Royal Society, the world's first scientific society, tended to be people of very strong faith. So Newton, I have a quote here from Newton. Newton was a man very much driven by his faith. He wrote more about theology than he did about science. Turned out to be quite a bad theologian and quite a good scientist, so that's why we've forgotten about that, but that's what he did. And here's Robert Boyle. You may remember him from Boyle's Law in secondary school, the father of modern chemistry. He was in Oxford. And he wrote a book called The Wisdom of God Manifested in the Works of Creation. He was a governor of the Corporation of the Spread of the Gospel of Jesus Christ in New England. It's a very fancy word for something like a missionary society today. So these were people of deep and strong faith. And these were the founders of the modern science as we know. And it's not surprising, say historians, because it was precisely those Christian roots that allowed science to flourish as it is. It's one of the reasons, in fact, that people often say to me, oh, is it hard to be a scientist and a Christian? I tell them, no. In fact, in Oxford, in physics, I have at least 10 senior colleagues of mine. I know of at least 10 who are active members of evangelical churches. And we meet once a term. We have a dinner together with about 25 of us, where we talk about things that, you know, we think interesting, like God and probability and those kinds of things that scientists like to worry about. But in fact, you find a lot more scientists, a lot more Christians in the science faculty than you find in the arts and the humanities faculties. And one of the reasons is that, in fact, science, and it's very easy to be a Christian in science. It's actually much harder to be a Christian in the business world, for example, or in things like that. It's actually easier to be a Christian in science. And people don't realize that. Okay. The public image is one of scientists all being atheists, but that's actually the opposite is true. So that was a little touch on science and a bit the history of science and tapestry arguments. Let's look at these questions beyond science, Popper's ultimate questions. How did everything begin? What are we here for? What's the point of living? What's the value of a human life, for example? Can we look at those questions? So let's say I asked you to use science to determine the value of a human life, why humans are valuable. Okay, that's incredibly important for our modern world. Say that all the ideas of human rights discourse is based on the idea that humans have basic rights, are valuable somehow independently of what they're like. But try to measure that with science. If you could try, you could be a chemist. I could try to measure how much all the, you know, all the things that make you up, all your chemicals, if you add them together, how much they're worth. Maybe if you have a lot of gold fillings, you'll be worth more than somebody who has less, right? I could be a physiologist and measure the size of your brain. I could be a psychologist and measure how smart you are. Or I could measure how the community values you. I could be even measure how much economic worth you generate, okay? But I think we all instinctively see that using these measures to say whether human life is valuable or not is impoverishing, is weak. In fact, I think it's really, really dangerous. And one of the things that's happening in our society today is that we have what some people might call a cut flower morality. So we have a morality of principles of value of human life, but they're cut from the roots of the fact that our value comes from God. And when you cut those roots, it's almost very hard to know where those that values come from. And so you start seeing voices that say, well, perhaps, this is like Peter Singer, a very famous philosopher in Princeton, who says, well, in some cases, perhaps a very young child is worth less than a well-developed chimpanzee because somehow there's something about intelligence or value in the community. You get all kinds of dangerous things that happen. So I think this is one thing, but it's really important to remember that science can't answer these questions. It can't say why we're valuable or not. It just can't. I want to give you an example from another one of my colleagues, Richard Dawkins, who tries something like this anyway. And here's from a very nice book, Unweaving the Rainbow, who says, the individual organism is not fundamental to life, but something that emerges when genes, which at the beginning of evolution were separate warring entities, gang together in cooperative groups as selfish cooperators. The individual organism is not exactly an illusion, it is too concrete for that, but it is a secondary derived phenomenon. So what is he saying here? He's saying basically, okay, we're made up of genes, and over time those genes kind of duped it out, and then the ones that were most successful are the ones that reproduce the most, and that's where our genes come from. Therefore, he says, we are nothing but a secondary phenomenon. Humans are nothing of valuable intrinsically. They're just what happens over time as your genes duke it out. Now, scientifically, he may be right or he may be wrong, but the really important question is, can you make these kinds of inferences based on a scientific statement like this? Let's say for the sake of the argument, the scientific statement is true and that the selfish gene approach is the best way of understanding how biological complexity came about. Is this actually a statement that you could make? Or even if that were true, could you make this statement? Well, let me give you a counterexample, just to give you an example of what I think Richard Dawkins is playing here. And by using a slightly facetious example, you might understand why I think that what he's doing here is completely wrong. It's called nothing buttery. So I think what Richard Dawkins is doing is nothing buttery. What is nothing buttery? So I got married a few years ago, and so before that, my wife and I were, you know, getting to know each other and engaged, and so there came a point when our relationship was getting more serious, and we were sitting in a beautiful restaurant, and there was candles, and there was flowers, and everything was just perfect, and things were going just great. And now imagine at some point she says to me, Ard, we've been going out for a while, but I want to know how well you know me. You know, do you really know what I'm made of? Okay. Now, all the guys in the audience will know this is a dangerous question. Okay. Sometimes the best strategy is some kind of distraction. You say, I think we should go on a trip, or... I think we should go buy something, something that will distract her. Let's say she persists and she doesn't, and you know, she really holds on and says, I want to know what you're made of. And you're kind of scrambling, and you think, well, I know what you're made of. You're made of chemicals. Humans are a collection of chemicals. In fact, you're made of about enough phosphorus for 2,000 matches, the average human, enough iron for one nail, enough chlorine to disinfect the swimming pool, and the average human about enough fat for 10 bars of soap. At which point I would get a slap. Maybe I should make it 0.1 bars of soap. No matter what I do, I'm going to get slapped. Because you can see, it's true. My wife is made of chemicals. But it's not true that she's nothing but made of chemicals. Just because I've explained that she's made of chemicals doesn't mean that I've explained who she is or what she's really like. Does that make sense? That's essentially what Richard Dawkins was doing. He's saying, humans are made of genes. Therefore, they're nothing but groups of genes. That's what he was saying. Does that make sense? And so another way of thinking about this is, if I explain something scientifically, does that exhaust all the meaning? you come into my house and there's water boiling on the stove, and you say to me, why is the water boiling? I say, well, there's a heat source underneath that's transferring energy across the container into the fluid. Okay? What then happens is the average velocity squared of the molecules increases, and the average velocity squared, which is proportional to the temperature, when that temperature equals 100 degrees Celsius, there is a collective phase transition from a condensed phase to an expanded phase, which we call boiling. That's why it's boiling. Now, if you were taking a thermodynamics exam with me, I might give you a pause. But you may come in and say, Art, why is the water boiling? And I say, well, I fancy a cup of tea. Would you like one? Okay. Now, the important point to remember is that both those explanations are correct explanations, and one doesn't exclude the other, and one doesn't exhaust the other. So just because I've understood how something works doesn't mean that I've exhausted the meaning of it. And a lot of what you see, particularly in the work of the new atheists, is saying, well, we understand this mechanism, therefore this is all that humans are. So I call that mechanism meaning, conflating mechanism and meaning. In fact, I'll give another relational illustration to say, can science really explain the most important things of life? Can it even be used for the most important questions of life? So here's a picture of a friend of mine, Bill Newsom. I was just giving a similar talk to this at Stanford about a few weeks ago. And it has this beautiful chapel called Memorial Chapel. And one day Bill, who's a very famous neuroscientist, was walking around the campus with one of his colleagues. And his colleague said, you know, we should blow up this building, okay? Because it's a monument to irrationality. His colleague here didn't know that Bill was a strong Christian. So Bill said, well, in that case, we should blow up my home, because my home is a monument to irrationality. Now, what did Bill mean by that? Well, let's say that you want to get married, and I'm looking around the room, the age profile, there's probably a number of you, probably a good number of you, that's something that's in the back of your mind, okay? So what would be a rational way of going about finding a marriage partner? Well, an irrational way would be to go onto the street, grab the first, the best person you see, and say, marry me, okay? If the person says yes, that's even more irrational. Instead, what you do is you get to know the person, you see whether you enjoy being together. You may even do these compatibility tests, which my wife and I did, which is quite interesting and very revealing, okay? And those signs helped a little bit, putting those things together. But at the end of the day, you can't marry a compatibility test, right? Just because I score 95% with you, maybe I don't fancy you, right? That's not going to work. Right? So in the end of the day, I can get to know somebody. I can ask friends that I trust, people that I trust, to say what do they think of the two of us together. But if I demand scientific certainty before I decide to get married, I'll never get married because I'll never know for sure. And one of the reasons I'll never know for sure is that parts of marriage are not accessible to me until I've taken that step. Right? I simply can't know. Does that make sense? So there's aspects of marriage which are only available until I've made a step, something like a step of faith. Okay? I can make a reasonable assessment that this is going to be good or bad, but I don't really know. It could go wrong, right? And still, in spite of that, people make these choices all the time. And this is one of many examples of what I think are truly important questions in life that you can't answer just with a scientific method. If you try, it's impoverishing. If you try to do multiple repeatable experiences in marriage, it's not a good idea. Right? Does that make sense? So you have to somehow, you know, this is one example of where obtaining reliable knowledge about something really important in life can't be captured entirely by the scientific method. And this is Bill's explanation to his colleague. And so I think that's something I'll get on a little bit more later in the talk, but I think that's an analogy I want you to stick, to hold with you and during the next few things I'm going to say. So I just said to you that science's success comes from its self-imposed limits. In fact, the reason why science is so powerful is precisely because it limits itself to those things which are repeatable and those things which are controllable. And there are all kinds of things, like marriage, for example, which it fundamentally can't answer. And it can't answer Popper's ultimate questions of how did everything begin, where are we all here for, and what is the point of living. So the question then is, how do I get answers to those questions? How do I find the answers to those really, really important questions of what life's about? How do I obtain reliable knowledge about these kinds of really important things? Given that science by itself, and no conceivable advance of science, to use the words of Peter Medawar, could ever answer those questions. And so I want to look now, the last section of my talk, at what I might call the reasons for God. So a common response I get from people is to say, well, how can you be a scientist and a Christian? Isn't faith just blind faith? To use Richard Dawkins, faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Faith is belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence. And Dawkins has obviously made quite a name for himself with his book, The God Delusion, basically pushing these kinds of ideas forward. And I'm going to ask myself, is this really the only option? Is the only alternative to science somehow blind irrationality? So Dawkins would say, well, some of these questions are simply not non-questions because science can't answer those questions. Here's Alvin Plantinga, probably the world's most distinguished Christian philosopher. And he was responding to Dawkins that, well, what Dawkins is really doing is something like this. It's like the man, you come down on a dark street, and there's just some moonlight, but you can't see that well, and you see a man on his hands and knees under a lamppost. And you ask him, what's going on? And he says, well, I've lost my keys, and I'm looking for them. So you get down, you look, and after a while, you can't find it. You say, well, but where did you lose your keys? He said, oh, but at that end of the street. But why are you looking for them here, then? Well, there's more light here. And what Plantinga says, what Dawkins is doing is saying, well, yeah, science shines a very clear, big light on things. So this is the only place where it's worth looking. That's not true. There's large parts of our lives that we have to look. Perhaps we can't apply the spotlights of science on it, but there are other ways of searching and other ways of finding. And one of the interesting things about this whole debate, and so the man that Mary, my wife, spoke to last night on the plane had been very much affected by Richard Dawkins' God delusion, and that's why he was trying to read on science to try to find something about the meaning of life. But here, the interesting thing is that that's a debate which in the public mind has seemed to be a really interesting and strong debate. But actually, the professional debate is very different. So here I quote Quentin Smith, the famous atheist philosopher in Michigan, who wrote an article, which I recommend if you like these kinds of things, where among other things he says, the justification of most contemporary naturalist views, which means basically views that say nature is all that there is defeated by contemporary theist arguments. And this article is a complaint where he's complaining about the fact that these theists have come in and have, at the moment, he said, if you put the best theists and the best atheists in a room, the theists would win hand down. And he's complaining because he says, clearly that's wrong because atheism is correct. So we need to rally the troops and sharpen our arguments. So this is the professional view, or one of the professional view of a very well-known philosopher, the editor, in fact, of this journal. And you contrast that with the kind of things that the incredible self-assurance with which the new atheists proclaim that faith is somehow dead. This explains why many of the reviews of Dawkins' book in the Professional Institute have been so scathing. So I take, for example, Terry Eagleton, a famous Marxist literary critic who wrote the London Review of Books. And the title of his review of Dawkins' God Delusion was Lunging, Flailing, Mispunching. And the first line goes something like this. Imagine somebody holding forth on biology whose only knowledge of the subject is the British Book of Birds. This is what it feels like to read Richard Dawkins on theology. So here's the interesting thing. So the sad thing, which is that the public kind of common debate about this is very far away from the professional, the more serious debate, and that many people somehow feel that science and it's like have undermined faith. Whereas in fact, I think that's not the case. Now, I can't go into all the details of this, it's a complicated thing, but if you somehow do think that science undermines faith, then I think it behooves you to read Plantinga and people like Quentin Smith and see why they're disagreeing and what the real arguments are about. And I'm going to just summarize, and again, in a kind of simple language, what are some of the types of arguments that somebody like Plantinga might use. So here's a quote from John Polkinghorne, a very famous physicist at Cambridge University and a theologian, who said this: if we are to understand the nature of reality, we have two possible starting points, either the brute fact of the physical world or the brute fact of a divine will and purpose behind that world, that physical world. So what is this saying in ordinary language? He says, really, when we think about what's important in life, what's not important in life, we have two possible starting points, either there is no God, there's nothing, or there is a God. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Right, so those are our two starting points. The question then is, can we then, from those two starting points, move on in a different direction? And the question then is, how would you move on from those two starting points to try to look at what is important to life, what matters and what doesn't matter? Is there a God or is there not a God? And I would argue that really, when we look at our own faith, it's much more like a tapestry. Okay, Just like the arguments I gave you from Merman's analogy for tapestry for science, in the same way, it can be something about our faith. So why do I, for example, why am I a Christian? Why do I believe in Jesus Christ? It's not only because there's one single thread of evidence, because there's a large number of different threads that cohere together in a really powerful way. Some of those are arguments about morality. Why is there morality? They're about beauty. Why is there beauty? Particularly for a Christian, the things related to the Bible or the resurrection, the life and teachings of Jesus Christ, and of course the experience of God in myself and in people that I know, love, and trust. And I think the way of thinking I'm going to hopefully persuade you is a good way of thinking about this, is based on a quote by C.S. Lewis, a very famous quote, where he said, "I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it, I see everything else." So the question is, if I start with these two brute facts, okay, in the beginning God, in the beginning nothing, those are two brute facts. Note the Bible itself doesn't really try to prove anything about God. It just says, it starts in the beginning God, okay, or in the beginning nothing. And then I look at the world around me. I look at beauty. I look at morality. I look at rationality, the basis for modern science. I look at intelligibility, mathematics, fine-tuning. Which of these two assumptions makes more sense? Which of them do I see the world more clearly? So let me give you one example about beauty. Okay, and you'll have to indulge me on this. This is something that I particularly like. I always like to sneak equations into churches. So here is one of my great heroes. Paul Dirac. Okay, Paul Dirac was a great mathematical physicist at Cambridge, at St. John's College. And in 1928, he was thinking of the following question. So physicists had come up with something called quantum mechanics. Now, how many here of you have heard of quantum mechanics? Oh, wow. Good church, Joel. All right, I like it. So quantum mechanics is a theory of really small things. Okay, and that had just been kind of worked out in 1926. And in 1905, Einstein had come up with the theory of special relativity, the theory of very fast things. Okay, you've probably heard of relativity. So you've got one theory about very fast things, one theory about really small things. And the problem was, they were two different theories, and you couldn't connect them together. And so he said, well, okay, I'll put them together. I'll try to figure out what happens when really small things go very fast. Okay, that's all. Okay, so for those of you hold on, I don't want to scare you off with the maths, but I think it's just cute to show. So here's the first equation, which is called the Schrödinger equation. Who's heard of the Schrödinger equation? Oh, still, good, okay, good. This is the equation, as far as quantum mechanics, is basically an energy equation. And the next equation I show you is basically E is mc squared, right? So here's E is mc squared. The square root of mc squared is E is mc squared, right? So here's mc squared, sorry, is just E is mc squared. And there's a little term that has to do with when things move. So you put those two things together, okay? And then he said, well, I'm going to do this for an electron. So you may not know this, but electrons have two components. They can be up or down, so you have a two-component equation, you put it together, and no matter how hard you try, you cannot take the quantum mechanics and the relativity and make a two-component equation that satisfies the right rules. You try and try and try. What you have to do is, in fact, include two other components. And mathematics pushes that guy. Don't worry about the proof. You can prove it. And what's amazing about it is that those two other components are antimatter. Okay, so you've probably heard of positrons, positron PET scans, PET scans, they use positrons. Antimatter is something like the opposite of matter. Matter and antimatter come together, they make energy, E is mc squared, they collide. And they explode into energy. So that's something really, really amazing that nobody would have ever imagined in their wildest dreams. But the great thing is, in 1932, Carl Anderson at Caltech discovered the positrons in cosmic rays. Okay, I remember as an undergraduate, I took advanced quantum mechanics class and I learned this proof. And I thought, okay, that cannot be true. Okay, how could a theory of very small things, a theory of very fast things, put them together, and the mathematics forces on you something as crazy as antimatter? Okay, that just seems unbelievable. And of course, the hubris of youth, I said, okay, Dirac must have missed something. So I spent the night working really, really hard, trying to figure out where he'd gone wrong. And of course, I had to bow to the master in more ways than one, I guess. Right? That's amazing, okay? And what some people have called that is the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics by Eugene Wigner, another very famous Nobel Prize winner, which is called a wonderful gift which you neither understand nor deserve. So in fact, science, physics, is full of amazing, really amazing, ways in which mathematics explains the world. In fact, mathematics predicts things about the world that we never would have imagined in our wildest dreams. So I think that's amazing. Here's Eugene Wigner, a quote from him. And I like this, I think it's amazing for a number of reasons. And one is that I think this is supremely beautiful. So something about the world is beautiful, nature is beautiful. When you go out to the stars, you see the stars, I think many of us sense a sense of wonder. Many people who have no interest in the divine will still sense something about God by looking at the stars. What science has done with our telescopes and our microscopes is all that has enhanced those capabilities. But here I want to show you something which I think is unbelievably beautiful. And although only perhaps those of, a few of you in the audience that will sweat for a while over physics will actually experience it yourselves, I'm hoping to at least lift part of the carpet and show you just how amazing it is. This is why many physicists talk about beauty in science, beauty in the equations. Somehow, beautiful equations tend to be the way the world works in the world of Dirac. And here's a quote from Henri Poincaré, another famous physicist who said, or mathematician, who said, "A scientist does not study nature because it is useful. He studies it because he delights in it, and he delights in it because it is beautiful. If nature were not beautiful, it would not be worth knowing. If nature were not worth knowing, life would not be worth living." You can see that he's a Frenchman. Okay, the passion there. So the question for all of us is, why is nature so beautiful? Okay, why is it beautiful? Is that more coherent with there being nothing at the base of the world? Is that more coherent with a God, with a logos, with an intelligence behind the universe? Which of those two things makes more sense? Which one illuminates better this thing that we see? I won't talk about this in so much detail, but there is, in fact, we can go further than this. The universe is full of constants that can have particular values, and it turns out those are fine-tuned very precisely to just the right values to allow, for example, life to occur. And that's called fine-tuning. And one of the big questions that people have is, why is the universe fine-tuned? Why are there all these laws of physics that point really, really, that seem to be finely tuned? And if they're slightly different, you can show, calculating it, that our universe, for example, would be chemically sterile. Why is that? And many people would say, well, it makes more sense starting from a theistic point of view, the view that there is a God behind the universe. And if I have maybe the questions, I'll touch just about this in more detail. So those are the kinds of, those two arguments I give you are just two of many examples of ways that you might look at the world and say, actually, starting from the brute fact of a divine will and purpose behind the world makes more sense to the world than starting from the brute fact of nothing behind the world. But that only brings me to the idea that there is something behind the world. How do I know that something is a somebody who might care for me? And that for Christians, of course, is based largely on the Bible and what the Word of God says to us. And so what is really important is the Bible reliable or is it made up? I can look at the life and teachings of Jesus Christ. Do they coherent? Do they make sense? Or are they just something that people have added in later? Was Jesus just a great teacher? Okay, or who was Jesus really? Or was he actually who he said he was? And we can look at things like Jesus claimed to rise from the dead. And for Christians, our faith rises or falls on the resurrection of the dead. Did that actually happen? Was there actually an empty tomb? And I'll touch very briefly on these questions. They're big ones that you can study a lot more detail on your own. So let me just touch one or two of them. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to use this principle of tapestry arguments. I'm going to try to weave together a tapestry and see whether I can make some sense of these questions. So the first really important question is the Bible reliable? And so I have a quote here from C.S. Lewis, a great professor at Oxford of literature, who wrote, "I've been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends, and myths all my life. I know what they are like. I know none of them are like this. Of this gospel text, there are only two possible views. Either this is reportage, or else some unknown ancient writer without known predecessors or successors suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern novelistic, realistic narrative." So what is he saying here in simpler words? If you read the gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that speak about Jesus and what he did, one of the really interesting things about them is they're full of little facts. Okay, it says when the disciples threw their net on the other side of the boat, when Jesus said to them to fish on the other side, they pulled up 153 fish. It talks about a man who carried the cross of Jesus, who was the father of Rufus and Alexander. It's full of little things like that. Today, we're used to that. If you read a novel, it's full of, if you're a good writer, you put those little tidbits and those little details in because that makes it more lively. But that's really only the last few hundred years that that genre of literature has emerged. Before that, nobody wrote in that style. It just wasn't the way they wrote. And so very clearly, Lewis says, these guys were writing down what they really thought that they saw. Okay, they weren't if they were trying to make it up, either they were the greatest literary geniuses of all time, or they wrote down what they really saw. Okay. And I think that's one of these tapestry arguments, one of these things that makes coherence to the idea that the Bible is reliable. There's many other things I could touch on, which I won't. The fact that we have many, many manuscripts, many multiple orders of magnitude more than we have for any other classical texts. We suggest that the text that we have is essentially what was originally written down, and many, many more things that we can talk about in the reliability of the Bible. But I thought I would just bring this one up as one of the examples of a tapestry argument for the reliability of the Bible. I think a very, very strong one for the fact that these people at least wrote down what they thought really happened. So what did they think really happened? Well, let's look at Jesus himself. The Gospels were writing about Jesus. If we look at Jesus' teaching, some of the most amazing teaching that has ever been written down. We also see that Jesus was not just a great teacher, which I think everyone agrees. The basic Christian principles that are the basis of our modern Western society, for example. But Jesus also did other things. He claimed to forgive other people's sins. Okay, it's kind of a strange thing. Let's say that Joel does something mean to one of you guys, okay, and he does it really, really mean, and it's nasty, and it's backstabbing and everything. And it comes out, and I say, well, Joel, I forgive you. Okay, that would be really bizarre, right? Because why should I forgive it? He did it to you, not to me, right? But Jesus does this, right? And Jesus, in fact, Jesus makes all kinds of he attributes to himself divine qualities. He basically says at one point, before Abraham was, I am. He says, he was divine. Now, the point is, what kind of people say that they're gods, right? Are these the kind of people that have great teaching? No, these are crazy people, right? These are people on par with somebody who calls himself a poached egg, right? These are crazy people. So either Jesus was lying, right, and he's making this stuff up, or he was crazy, he was a lunatic, right? Or what he said is actually true. But I think what's really important, I have a quote here from C.S. Lewis, who said, a man who is merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on level with a man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make a choice. Either this man was and is the son of God, or else a madman or something worse. But let's not come up with any patronizing nonsense about him being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. So when I put this thing together, we see that you can't think about Jesus as if he was just a great moral teacher. You have to either accept or reject him. That's the choice that he gives to you. And I think that's just the way the world is. That's the way the gospel narrative is. And I think for those of you in the audience who are thinking about this or wondering about this, I think it's really important that you take something like this seriously. I don't think this is the kind of thing you can necessarily evade. So that was the thing about Jesus, liar, lunatic, or Lord. The third thing I'll touch on briefly is the really important principle of the resurrection. And I have it here. Again, I'm just touching these very briefly. So here's a book by Tom Wright, a very well-known theologian. I think it's probably one of the best books on this topic, called The Resurrection of the Son of God. Wright is a great classic scholar. And he points out in there seven huge jumps from the Judaic background that people were living in, complete disjunctions in the way that people understood that Jesus rose from the dead. And he points out that when we study intellectual history, we always can see how ideas morph and they change and they're influenced by other sources. But here is something that changes so dramatically, it's completely different and new. It almost certainly is the kind of thing that people would only write down if they really believed that it happened. In fact, what's really interesting, if you look at these tapestry arguments again for whether the Bible, people in wrote the New Testament, really believe that Jesus rose from the dead, there's many examples. One of my favorite ones is the fact that the first people to see Jesus risen from the dead were women. And in those days, women's voice did not count in court, for example. So if you were making it up, the last thing you would do was have a woman come and be the first witness, because that nobody in that ancient world would take that seriously. So very clearly, the writers thought that this had really happened. Okay. In fact, the writers and the early Christians, almost all of them died for their faith. They died for believing that Jesus had really risen from the dead. And that's not the kind of thing you do if you're making it up. So this is one of many arguments, I think, that suggests very strongly that the early Christians really believed that Jesus rose from the dead. So I gave you a number of little arguments, tapestry arguments, why I believe in Jesus Christ. I touched very briefly on why I think the Bible is reliable. I touched very briefly on the resurrection, on the life and teaching of Jesus Christ. But I think the most important thing about how we come to know somebody, how we come to the faith, is our own experience. And I don't think experience is something that we should discount. Certainly in my own life, when I was growing up in Gabon in Central Africa, it was the experience of seeing some of my friends radically changed when they became Christians that really attracted me to the gospel. So I have two friends, Hilaire and Yolande, who were living in Libreville, the capital city of Gabon, and for all kinds of reasons had broken lives with multiple children, with multiple partners all spread around. And I watched them coming from very, very broken backgrounds come to faith, actually meet each other, get married, go on, gather the children that had been spread around various grandmothers and uncles and exes, and make a real family. And today, if you go to their home, Hilaire's built a very big home because he has typically 20, 30 people eating there every day. And you see them coming home with a big armful of baguettes to feed everybody. And that is, I think, real life. That's what happens when God changes people's lives. And that had an enormous impact on me. I thought, wow, that's what I want. I want to live that kind of life. I want to live a life that really is changed in that way. And that's how I became a Christian. And I think probably in this room, many of you who came to Christ at some point, it was that kind of relational interaction that was really important. So I want to conclude and then have a little epilogue at the end. So science is powerful, I told you. It's very powerful. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. But it can't answer everything that we put to it. I told you there are other ways of achieving reliable knowledge. In fact, you are using these all the time. Each of you is a little philosopher in some way or the other, and you're using, every time you make a choice for a relationship or against a relationship, make a choice of where you're going to live, what you're going to do, you're not using just a scientific method. You can't. You're using other ways of obtaining reliable knowledge. I argued that actually when we do science, what we really do is not just single arguments, single threads, but many threads that we weave together into a tapestry of arguments. And I very, very briefly touched on a number of arguments that I think together weave a very strong tapestry for the existence of a God, for the brute fact of a will and purpose behind this world. And moreover, I believe you can take the same types of arguments for the reliability of the Bible and based on that make a strong argument for the Christian God, for Jesus Christ. But at the end, I think truth, you know, is relational. You don't have a relationship with a set of philosophical ideas. So, for example, my wife came home this morning from South Africa. We've been apart for some time. And giving her a hug and feeling her was just an amazing, amazing experience, an experience of being loved, an experience of loving someone back. And what Jesus Christ claims in the Bible and what I've experienced in my life is that he loves me more, much more, than anyone that I've ever loved or that anyone I know has ever loved me. Right? Just take a minute and think about the person who you love the most, maybe a spouse or a parent or a child, and think how much you love that person and hopefully how much that person loves you back. God loves you infinitely more than that. Okay? It's important in a relationship that a relationship is based on truth, but I can't insist on continual scientific proof that my wife loves me if I want to have a healthy relationship. I have to take a step of faith. I have to go forward and assume that she loves me. And in fact, what I find is when I make that step, and then she makes that step, actually, together, we grow to something that becomes very beautiful and very powerful. So if you're considering becoming a Christian, it's important to think about whether the Christianity is coherent, whether it's rational, whether it makes sense. It must do those things. But that's not all. You also have to take a step of faith, because there are aspects of being a Christian, relational aspects, that you'll only know when you yourself make that step of faith. So thank you very much. Question. Great. So I promised I would do some questions. I think you've had a chance to text them, and they're going to appear on the screen. Is that right? Great. So, okay, great. Okay, that's a great question. So, I'm glad that you agree that science has limits. I think many atheists do. And it's true that just because it has limits, I hope I showed you this, because limits doesn't mean I should accept any irrational belief, just like I gave in my relational analogy. If the alternative to science is not jumping onto the street and grabbing the first person that I see and saying, marry me, I have to think about whether we connect together. And so the really difficult question about what about other faiths, the first step to take is that actually faith can't all be true. So for example, if I believe in reincarnation, that I'm reincarnated, or if I believe that that's not true, they can't both be true. It can't be true for you, but not true for me. One of the two has to be true. Okay? So truth really matters. And I think that for Christians, it's important that we believe that our faith is true, that our faith is based on something rational. And what I was trying to argue was that oftentimes we have this idea of rationality being you have to doubt everything until proven that it's true. This is a kind of Descartesian or Humean approach. But actually, none of us really lives our life that way. And I think that's not really, and if you read Plantinga in a lot more detail on this, that's not really the right way, I think, of looking at the world. Instead, it's good to say, if I start from the point of view that there is a God behind the world, does that make more sense of the world? Does that make more sense of the fact that we have morality, that there is beauty? Does that make it clearer to understand why mathematics explains the world so well, why there is fine-tuning? I think it does, and I think it's up to you to a large extent to make up your mind about those things. If you're a scientist particularly, you can look at those arguments. Same is true of the Bible. Right? You can ask yourself, is the Bible reliable or not reliable? You can't get scientific proof of it in the sense that you can't put the Bible in a repeatable test tube. You can't go back 2,000 years ago and repeat the experiments. That's just not available to you. But hopefully I explained to you that all the really important questions in life, or not all, but most of the important questions in life, are not amenable to the scientific method. That doesn't mean the alternative is irrationality. That means the alternative is careful thinking and trying to put together a picture of the world. And the important thing to remember is whether you like it or not, you have already made a picture of the world. You already have in the back of your mind a tapestry argument for how you think the world puts together. And there's no choice, because we all are philosophers. You all have ideas about how the world works and what is important and what's not important. And the question isn't simply whether you have those ideas. The question is whether those ideas make the most sense of the world around you. I disagree with the second part of your question. I don't think I picked one irrational belief over another. I hoped I showed you that there are good rational reasons for believing that Christianity makes sense. But I hope I also showed you that the kind of scientific style of looking for truth is not going to be enough to find the relational truth of a life living with Jesus Christ. And so I hope at least that if these kind of questions about science and the right to the Bible are things that vex you, that you'll read people that know a lot about it and think about what they say. But fundamentally, I hope also that you'll be open to the possibility that perhaps God may speak to you. The Bible actually claims that God rewards those who diligently seek him. And so if it's true, if the Bible is true, you can do a test. You can see whether God will reward you, whether God will somehow speak to you. But you have to be open. You have to be diligent in your seeking. And either the Bible is true, and this eventually will be true in your life one way or the other, or it's not true, okay? But it's a test you can do. So, the next question. How accurate is carbon dating? We're always being told that the bone is 10 million years old. How do they know, and where does this fit in with an 8,000-year-old Bible? Okay, so that's a more complicated kind of an in-house topic among Christians. And the question is, if we look at Genesis, for example, is Genesis a scientific text? Is it telling us that the world is this old, or is it actually, or is it not? Right? And the first thing I want to say is that it's really important to look very carefully at the Bible and see what it says. I'm debating somebody on this topic in Brighton in May, 15th of May. in Calvary Church, is that Brighton, right? I'm baiting somebody in where he believes that the earth is 8,000 years old, and I think the earth is much older than that. And we're debating that. But fundamentally, for Christians, it depends on whether the Bible is true or not. So I think carbon dating is fairly accurate. I think there's other ways of measuring the age of the earth, which all suggest that the earth is quite old. So simple things as the size of the universe. You can look at stars and how stars move around each other. And you can calculate, basically, with their velocity and the gravity. And that explains why the Milky Way, for example, is a spiral galaxy. But you do need very large amounts of time for that to happen. And there's no problem for me in bringing that together with the Bible, because I think very clearly the Genesis text is not giving a journalistic narrative, like this happened, then that happened, then that happened, and that happened, as the way, say, Luke does, right? Luke says, writes to his friend Theophilus and says, this is what we saw and heard. So one little simple example, in the days of creation, on the fourth day, it says God created the sun and the moon. That's what our translations say. But the actual correct Hebrew words are much closer to greater lamp and lesser lamp. So why have a sun and the moon only on the fourth day? How can you have a day without the sun and the moon? In fact, the church father Origen already, the third century, said, what man of intelligence could believe that these are literal days when the sun and the moon are not created until the fourth day? And if you look a little bit carefully, you see that the words used are not sun and moon, but bigger lamp and lesser lamp. What it's really saying is the sun and the moon are lamps. They're created objects in the sky. Okay? You say, okay, fine. Right? But for the people of that time, they worshipped the sun and the moon. Okay? They were astrologers. Everybody was an astrologer. The intelligentsia, the scientific establishment, if you want to call it that, believed that the sun and the moon were living beings. So saying that was about as crazy as if I say to you today, the sun and the moon are living beings who control your life. Hopefully you don't believe that. Right? But at that time, that was a scientifically testable statement that the first chapter of Genesis is making. And we now know that it's true, but it's taken many thousands of years before we could actually be sure that the sun and the moon were not living beings. And so what I think that really clearly says is that this text is not giving a description of things in the order that it happens, but rather trying to explain the meaning of what happens. Okay? And in fact, when it does that, it actually sneaks in some really interesting scientific statements that have turned out to be true. But that's why I think, and by and large, this question of carbon dating is a red herring. But that's a very, very brief and insufficient answer to a lot of other questions. So, yeah, good. Is scientific theory only as accurate as the most current experimental results, and yet presented as more reliable than the gospel, even though the Bible constantly endorses scientific truth? Okay, let me see if I can. So maybe I'll take that question slightly differently and say there's several, the question actually begs a few other interesting questions. And so it's true, scientific theory is only as accurate as experimental results. Now, we theorists like to believe that our theories are pretty robust, and if experiments aren't quite right, that means that they didn't get the experiments, they must have done something wrong. But I think that in principle, this is true. Science progresses, experiments get better. And sometimes one of the dangers that scientists have is that we over-push how much we understand something. Sometimes that's because we work for bragging. Sometimes because we're hoping that you'll give us more money. There can be all kinds of reasons for that. So I think it is true that we have to be careful when we look at scientific results to see how reliable they are. And the interesting thing is the more that science becomes applicable to our day-to-day life, say something like climate change or medical science, the harder, sometimes the weaker these tapestries are, and sometimes the more they become frayed. Look at, should you drink coffee or should you not drink coffee? Should you drink wine, should you not drink wine? These things are flipping back and forth all the time. Whereas I would say that something like quantum mechanics that I showed you is incredibly reliable. But the last part of this question is a question about, is science more reliable than the truth of the gospel, even though the Bible constantly endorses scientific truth? The Bible does endorse scientific truth. The Bible obviously is not a scientific textbook. This question about what is more reliable or not reliable is a little bit of a non-question, because science limits itself to answering those questions that refer to things that are repeatable. Sometimes we might say that we say God sustains the world, okay? And what science studies is the customs of the creator, the regular ways that God sustains the world. If God were to stop sustaining the world wouldn't grind to a halt, the world would stop existing. So science studies regular ways that God sustains the world, and that's a very limited set of things that we can study. Whereas there are all kinds of more important questions, like who are you? What gives you value? Okay, those kinds of questions the Bible endorses, and I believe the Bible is reliable on. So the problem with what you often see, somebody says, well, look, here is the really bright light, okay, that shines really clearly on those things that can be repeatable all the time. And here is a much wider set of really important truth that I can't use, I can't repeatably study, because I can't go back 2,000 years ago and redo the resurrection. Right? So therefore, the resurrection is unreliable. But I hope the main point I got across from you, hopefully, was that is a false distinction. Yeah, great. More questions? Do you think believing Christians are so afraid of scientific discoveries? Can we sometimes miss out on a lot of beauty because we are paranoid? If so, perhaps being this dogmatic proves our faith to be weaker, not stronger. Well, I think one of the interesting things is that there are many Christians who are scientists, many more than I think the general Christian public realizes. But I do often find that I come to a new Christian church or new Christian gathering and I say, I'm a scientist, and people go, ooh, you know. I don't know whether it's because I'm afraid I'm going to make them solve problems, or because sometimes they're a bit afraid that somehow science is going to undermine faith. And I think that's unnecessary. That's a very sad state of affairs sometimes. That's unnecessary. So I would say I think that some believing Christians are afraid of scientific discoveries, but many believing Christians love scientific discoveries. Right? So for those that are afraid of scientific discoveries, I do think that they miss out on beauty, and I do think it weakens their faith. I think it's an unnecessary fear.